E. Casey Foundation.
Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Today, we're going to see what kind of legal trouble the president and his associates might be in. Last week, President Donald Trump's longtime attorney was sentenced to 3 years in prison, in part for campaign finance violations, coordinating with Trump to pay two women for their silence over alleged affairs with Trump. We'll speak with a law professor who specializes in campaign finance law, and we'll take your questions. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org. You can also text 813-433-0885. Our guest today is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport. She's a Brennan Center Fellow, and she's author of the book Corporate Citizen, An Argument for the Separation of Corporation and State. I want to welcome you back to WMNF's Midpoint, Professor Torres-Spellacy.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. I want to begin with the sentencing of Cohen. He signed a plea deal and admitted to what crime?
He has admitted to a number of crimes. His sentencing judge said that he was pleading guilty to a veritable smorgasbord of crimes. That includes two campaign finance violations. Essentially, he violated the contribution limit for an individual. He also violated the Tobin Act, which is a law from 1907 that makes it illegal for a corporation to spend in American politics.
And is that corporation the National Enquirer's parent American Media?
It is. And shortly after Mr. Cohen was sentenced, so he was sentenced to 3 years confinement, AMI also entered into a non-prosecution agreement with the Department of Justice, and in that agreement, the parent company of the National Enquirer admitted that they violated the Tobin Act. So now you have Cohen admitting that he violated the Tobin Act, AMI admitting they violated the Tobin Act, and in Cohen's elocution with his judge, he said that he broke these campaign finance laws at the direction of then-candidate Trump.
Who in the indictment is named as Individual One. You don't necessarily see the president's name, but it's clear that we're talking about the president of the United States.
Correct. And in his elocution, and sorry, I fall into using legal terms. Let me speak like a normal human being. When he was talking to the judge who was sentencing him, he made it clear that he did certain crimes at the behest of the president, not while he was president, but rather when he was a candidate for president in 2016.
And the president's current lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, went on the talk shows yesterday and said essentially that Cohen is lying. But it seems to be that we're guessing that there might be evidence that Cohen is telling the truth because of this other indictment or this other, I guess, crime that was alleged through American media and its CEO, David Pecker, the parent company of National Enquirer. So there might be some sort of corroboration there.
It's possible. As an outsider, I don't get to see all of the evidence that prosecutors have, but Mr. Cohen was known to be an avid audio recorder, so it's possible that they have audio tapes of some of the planning for these crimes. The other possibility is the old trick in Watergate, which is prosecutors follow the money, and so there's going to be documentation about transactions between Mr. Cohen, Mr. Cohen's LLC, the National Enquirer, the women who were silenced. So there is documentary evidence that prosecutors make the case against Mr. Cohen, AMI, and possibly the president.
And we'll back up a second and talk about the money that we know about. And that's these two payments. So one is a $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. I guess I maybe should say alleged payment to Stormy Daniels. She wrote about it in her book, and she's talked about it in the media. She's, of course, a famous adult film star and director. And then this one, that was the one that Cohen presumably made to Stormy Daniels. And then the American media made a $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal, who I believe was a Playboy model. And so these are the campaign finance law violations. Why would these hush payments, if you can give me the liberty to call them that, why would they be violations of campaign finance law?
Because they were made to further the campaign of Donald Trump at a time when he was a federal candidate for federal office, namely the presidency. And so when you give payments that help a federal candidate, you can unwittingly, in some cases, sometimes wittingly, violate campaign finance laws, because the campaign finance laws are aimed at giving voters transparency about the money transactions that are going on to help or attack federal candidates. And what appears to have happened with this part of the Trump campaign is that they were not putting all of their campaign finance transactions in their reports that are due to the Federal Election Commission. And that in itself is a violation of the law. You have to be transparent about the money that's being spent in politics. So one problem with these payments is they were off the books. Another problem is they were too big. An individual can give $2,700, or at least in that election, that was the limit, to a federal candidate that they want to support. And these payments were way too big to be legal. And then finally, when you involve corporations, corporations cannot give money or things of value directly to federal candidates. So these crimes are sort of multi-layer crimes, not disclosed, too big, and using corporate entities in ways that is illegal under our campaign finance laws.
And one of the arguments that Rudy Giuliani was making yesterday is that these weren't campaign violations, these weren't campaign contributions, these expenditures or contributions to the what we're saying is the campaign, but they weren't to the campaign. They just were unrelated to the presidential campaign of Donald Trump.
Well, that's why it's so important that in Cohen's plea and in the non-prosecution agreement for AMI, both AMI and Cohen admit that the purpose of the payments was to further the election of Donald Trump, which brings them into the purview of campaign finance law.
And the president tweeted a very specific thing that I would like you to comment on, if you don't mind. Trump tweeted that he never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. Does that matter?
So this gets farther into criminal law than I normally go, because I'm an election lawyer. So white-collar crime and campaign finance are like kissing cousins. But the general idea here is what makes a conspiracy. And you don't have to have Donald Trump saying to Mr. Cohen, break the law. So long as there's a meeting of the minds between Cohen, Trump, and in this case, the head of the National Enquirer. And if there is a meeting of the minds on breaking the law, that is a criminal conspiracy.
Our guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law. We're talking about the recent sentencing of Mr. Cohen, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison for breaking campaign finance violations. You were just talking a minute ago about how campaign finance violations knowing that whether you're breaking the law or not. This happened, a similar situation, it seems, happened a few years ago with former vice presidential candidate John Edwards, and he ended up not being convicted of these crimes. How is that similar or different?
So they are similar in that they both involve hush payments to a mistress. But there are things that distinguish the two cases. Number one, with John Edwards, he was not a candidate at the time that those payments were made to his mistress, and which is different than the Trump situation with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, where not only was he a candidate, he was a candidate for president, and the election was just weeks away. So that's one way that a prosecutor could distinguish those two cases. Another thing to remember is John Edwards actually was charged with this crime. Now, he was acquitted by a jury of his peers, and Mr. Trump has not been charged with anything. So that's another way you can distinguish these two cases. And what we don't know is if he were charged, as in the president, or perhaps once he is no longer president, then he too would have the ability to either plead guilty the way his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, did, or go to a jury trial. And then it would be in the hands of jurors to decide whether he was guilty or innocent of any crimes he is alleged to have committed.
Well, that certainly brings us to the question of, can a president be indicted and charged with a crime or arrested? What are your thoughts, or what's the history and the legal precedent there?
So we are in uncharted territory. The closest we have come to this was during the Nixon administration, where there were points at which President Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in certain crimes, but because he was pardoned by his successor, President Ford, we never got the criminal trials against Richard Nixon, and it's possible that we'll never get criminal trials here either. Whoever succeeds President Trump may, like, in the interest of calming the nation down, could pardon him. So there's always this possibility that there will be no criminal trials. And the other way that we are in sort of uncharted territory is Nixon resigned. And so you didn't have to have a prosecutor wrestle with the question of trying to indict a sitting president. I see no signs of President Trump resigning, and so this question will be a novel one for courts if they have to go down this road.
And one way that might happen is there's an election coming up in 2020, and if President Trump does not win that election, if he's no longer president in the beginning of 2021, that year, I think it's August or October of that year, is when the statute of limitations would run out on these crimes, if I'm not mistaken. So you might see, if it goes that far, you might see that happening, that question coming up again after President Trump leaves office in 2021.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. The statute of limitations for campaign finance crimes is 5 years. One of the other open questions is if the standard from the Department of Justice is that you can't indict a sitting president, which is the current policy, then that opens a sort of separate line of inquiry about whether the statute of limitations should be told for crimes that a president is alleged to have committed. So the weird thing with the statute of limitations is if Trump wins re-election, then arguably, the statute of limitations would run out during his second term in office. But I think there would be a strong argument to be made to a court that can't be the way these laws were intended to work. No one is above the law, and thus, if we're going to not prosecute sitting presidents, then we also have to toll the statute of limitations, which means it would wait for that person until their 8 years or 4 years in office is up.
Our guest is Chara Torres-Pellacy. She's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport. She's also a Brennan Center Fellow. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa. It's 12:20 in the afternoon. If you'd like to ask a question, the number is 813-239-9663. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. And we're talking mostly about the crimes that have in people surrounding President Trump have been charged with. Just want to quickly read something from the AP of crimes today of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's associate, a one-time business partner of Flynn, has been arrested and charged with illegally lobbying to have a Turkish exile returned from the U.S. The man made an initial appearance today in federal court in Virginia. He's indicted on charges including failing to register as a foreign agent. According to the indictment, the man was vice chair of Flynn's business group, the Flynn Intel Group, and the two worked to have the cleric Fethullah Gulen extradited to Turkey. I don't know if this is too far afield from election law for you to talk about the charges that Flynn has been associated with and now his business associates. Is that something you could talk about?
I guess briefly. So General Flynn is in the process of facing sentencing. He stands charged of lying to the FBI. And he has been a cooperating witness with federal prosecutors. And it's entirely possible that this indictment today of his former business associates is the product of 19 meetings with prosecutors as he tells them about various crimes that he knows about. And what we saw with the sentencing memo in Flynn's case from the special counsel's office, is the special counsel's office said that Flynn was such an effective cooperator that they suggested zero jail time for him, even though the crime that he pled guilty to, which is lying to the FBI, could get him jail time under other circumstances. So it's entirely possible that the indictment today of his former business partners is the result of Flynn's confessions to prosecutors.
There are a lot of people who are hoping that President Donald Trump will talk to Mueller, Robert Mueller, the special counsel. But his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, went on television yesterday and said, "Over my dead body, will he talk to him?" Why would that be? First of all, why do you think that President Trump and his attorney would not want to talk to Mueller? Maybe that's an easy question. And the second is, what might we learn if they do talk?
Well, the special counsel is looking at two basic lines of inquiry, though I think his mandate allows him to look at any crime that he sort of trips over during his investigation. So I think his investigation is getting bigger and bigger. But where he started was looking at Russian interference in the 2016 election and whether any Americans helped the Russians in that effort. And then the other thing that the special counsel appears to be investigating is the question of obstruction of justice. So has the president obstructed justice? And so I think the reluctance on the part of some of President Trump's lawyers to talk to the special counsel is the fear that he might incriminate himself or that he might commit perjury during the interview with the special counsel. And lying to the special counsel is itself a crime. And so I think the way that the Trump lawyers frame this is that it's a perjury trap. The way I would frame it is there's no such thing as a perjury trap. Just tell the truth. But as the fact checkers at the Washington Post might tell you, they had to create a new category of lies called the bottomless Pinocchio because of the amount of lying that comes out of this particular administration.
So it wouldn't even necessarily need to be a very elaborate perjury trap in order for the president perhaps to catch himself in a lie.
Possibly.
Well, let me read this one comment before I let you go, and maybe you can respond to it. Adam out there in cyberspace writes, I think we also need to remember there's the possibility that Trump is already under sealed indictment and could be hit with it as soon as he leaves office. Have you seen any evidence, Professor Torres-Pellissey, that that might be the case, that it just might be an indictment waiting for the president to leave office?
Well, there is this curious thing that's going on in the D.C. circuit, which is the circuit that would have, one of the circuits that would have jurisdiction over the president. And special counsel Bob Mueller has been litigating something under seal for several weeks now. And because it's under seal, we in the public can't quite tell what in the world that is. And people have, it's a parlor game of like predicting what that is. One possibility is it's Roger Stone, complaining about the appointment of the special counsel. But it also could be a subpoena to the president or something along those lines. But as I said, it's completely sealed. We have no idea what is going on with that litigation. So eventually it'll have to come out because we can't have secret laws and we can't have secret rulings from courts. And so with all the things that are going on with the special counsel, I would encourage everyone who is watching this to be patient. Most special counsels have taken longer than this and have had fewer results than Special Counsel Mueller, and he has been wildly effective. He's indicted lots of people. He has a lot of guilty pleas, but I think he is just getting started.
And is there anything else that our listeners should know about any of these campaign election violations or anything else that's connected with President Trump?
Well, it's interesting. The investigations into Trump and his orbit seem to get bigger every day. And some of the campaign finance violations that I think have been ignored so far, but I sort of suspect that the special counsel has not totally forgotten about them, is there was this strange episode during the 2016 campaign where the Trump campaign was sending out emails to members of parliament in several countries asking for money for the Trump campaign. And that is illegal in two ways. Number one, it's illegal to ask for a foreigner to help a federal candidate. And number two, it's doubly illegal if you ask a foreign government to help in a American election. And those emails came from Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and the candidate himself. And so one of the unexplored areas of campaign finance that we might see enforced for once is this ban on foreign solicitations. So stay tuned. Who knows how this story will end?
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks for pointing that out. Well, I want to thank you for joining me on WMNF's Midpoint, Professor Torres-Pellissey.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. Chara Torres-Pellissey is a professor of law at Stetson University of Law in Gulfport. She's a Brennan Center Fellow. She's also the author of the book Corporate Citizen, An Argument for the Separation of Corporation and State. And if you have thoughts about this topic, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. I normally do this at the beginning of the show, but I wanted to get straight to our guests. So right now I'm going to go to a couple of comments that were left to by our listeners about our last show. Our guest was from Environment Florida. We talked about several topics, including the Trump administration's plan to allow seismic airgun blasting to search for oil and gas reserves under the Atlantic Ocean. And we talked about St. Petersburg's push to ban some single-use plastics. So we're going to hear these two listener comments. And right after that, we'll take your phone calls. So give us a call, 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. Or text 813-433-0885.
My name's John. I'm calling from Oregon. Grew up in Florida, though, so I still listen, catch the show every now and then. One of your callers, when he was talking about single-use plastics, said that the approach puts the burden on the consumer. Single-use plastics are intended for a lot of consumer products. Besides single-use plastics, consumers in general and I'm part of it. I'm not trying to say like I'm perfect. I drink a bottle of soda every couple of weeks and use other single-use plastics, but I'm aware of it and I try not to use it. Consumers are part of the problem. So by trying to pass the blame off onto large corporations, humans just aren't going to address this issue of single-use plastics and a bunch of other stuff that are used by consumers. So I admitted to it. You need to look at yourself as part of the problem, and you need to figure out what you can do to deal with this. It's terrible. I mean, to make it sound like it's not really the fault of the consumer that there's a huge patch of plastic in the middle of the Pacific that's two times the size of Texas is just kidding yourself. I don't necessarily mean this at the particular person, but there's a lot of consumers that seem to think that because they're a member of Greenpeace, it's okay that they go out and buy their disposable plastic drinks every day or whatever other single-use plastic stuff that they need to buy. Thanks, Sean. Great show. Bye.
Hey there. This is Hunter Miller, campaign organizer for Oceana, calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. I just wanted to thank Sean for talking about the threats from seismic paragon blasting. If folks are interested in learning more and definitely taking action to stop the threat to our marine mammals, fish, and wildlife in our oceans, they can find out three easy ways that they can take an action. They just need to visit www.oceana.org/blocktheblast to help our marine mammals and stop this crazy seismic air gun blasting from happening. Thanks so much, and I appreciate you covering important stories and topics like this.
Well, those were two listeners commenting about our last show. Later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail that I'll play next show. You can always listen to previous shows and comment on our stories on our website, wmnf.org/news. You can join us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at WMNF News. Well, the number to call in, 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And we're going to hear from Rudy Giuliani in a little bit, but let's go to Hugh in Dover and see what Hugh has to say. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, Ms. Cadan. Thank you for taking my call. I have to agree with everybody on this. Normally, I've supported Donald Trump in most of the things that he's trying to get accomplished, but with regards to the environment, I just recently watched a video presentation, a documentary that was Meryl Streep was the voice of the commentator, and she followed a family of polar bears through the Antarctica, and it talked primarily about the acidic level of the ocean up there and how it's causing the ice to melt, and that it's making it harder for the caribou to find food because the seasons are taking longer now for it to turn back into winter. And it was just, I mean, it really opened my eyes. You think about things that are happening locally, but you don't really think about, the larger world impact.
Well, thanks for pointing that out to me. I have not seen the film. It looks like it's called To the Arctic. Is that what it is?
Yes, it's an incredible show. I highly recommend it. It's just fun to watch. It's really cute to see the polar bears and how they swim. I mean, they use their front paws to swim, and this mother protecting her two cubs. I mean, at one point you get so afraid, for those two little cubs that you just have to see it. But the biggest thing is the acidity level of the ocean up there, what it's doing to the sea urchins and doing to the ocean itself. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know why it's causing the ice to melt, but we definitely have to do something.
All right, I appreciate that, Hugh, and we'll definitely follow that issue as the weeks and months go on. I appreciate you calling in. Thank you for that call.
You're very welcome, Sean. Thank you, too.
All right, thanks, Hugh. 813-239-9663. We have Bruce in Tampa. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, I wanted to comment on bottles, plastic bottles. I'm a retired physician and avid runner, and I've reached the tipping point where for health and public health reasons, and environmental reasons, have stopped drinking out of plastic bottles. I bought a canteen on Amazon.com, and plus all the ingredients in these flavored waters, as well as Gatorade and most products out there, do have small ingredients that are somewhat toxic. They meet a certain standard that allows them to be produced. There's an FDA categorization called GRAS, the it stands for ingredients that are below toxicity but are still identifiable. So I think overall, for many reasons, turning to a canteen of some kind that does not have plastic and doesn't have biodegradables in it is a much better way to go.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for that call. I appreciate that. And I think that whatever we can do to reduce our impact on the globe is helpful. So thanks for those tips. And if you missed it, if any of our listeners missed it, you can go back and listen in the archives to our 10 o'clock show this morning, Sustainable Living. They were talking about ways during the holiday season that you can reduce your impact on the planet. And our very own Janelle Irwin was on that show, so it was really great to have her in the studio. 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. Text 813-433-0885. And I want to, I know a lot of you want to talk about the environment and about ways we can live more sustainably, but I do want to also continue to focus on the issues of the Trump administration. And I have a little bit of the audio from Fox News yesterday. Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani told Fox News Sunday that President Trump will sit down one-on-one with special counsel Robert Mueller over my dead body. That's what Giuliani said. He spoke with host Chris Wallace. I'm going to play just a few minutes of this, but while it's on, why don't you call in and let us know what you think about what Giuliani is saying, what our guest earlier said. We had on Chiara Torres-Spellis, a professor of law at Stetson University, to talk about the Michael Cohen sentencing and how that affects Donald Trump and whether eventually he might be charged. We don't know at this point, but we'll find out someday. But listen to Rudy Giuliani, the attorney for Donald Trump, talking on Fox News Sunday yesterday.
Did Mr. Trump direct Michael Cohen to pay off these two women or not?
No, the truth is actually what Cohen testified to under oath before Congress and what he repeated numerous times on surreptitious tape recordings that he made, which is that the president didn't know about this until some time into it. He did find out about it and eventually reimburse him. But, you know, this is a hard thing to do because lawyers do this all the time. But, Chris, even if it were true, it's not a crime. The payment of money in a situation like this has been covered in the Edwards case. Not only the acquittal and hung jury in the Edwards case, but the fact that the FEC looked at those Edwards violations and determined they weren't violations.
I promise you we're going to get to that in a minute, but let's get to the simple fact question of whether the president directed Cohen to make these payments or not. Cohen says that the president is not to be believed. Here he is.
The man doesn't tell the truth, and it's sad that I should take responsibility for his dirty deeds.
Mayor Julie.
That's some lawyer. That is some lawyer. He was the lawyer in that situation.
Well, but does the president tell the truth or not?
The president is telling the truth, yes. This man is lying. Now, is that a big surprise to you that Michael Cohen is lying? The man got up in front of the judge and said, I was fiercely loyal to Donald Trump. Nonsense, he was fiercely loyal to him. He taped him, lied to him, revealed the tape, and did something a lawyer I've never heard ever did, tape record his own client.
But sir...
He sat there with Chris Cuomo, told him he wasn't being taped, showed him a draw, and he lied to him and taped him for 2 hours. The man is a complete pathological liar.
But
he cannot be believed.
But sir, let's turn to.
And they'll never put him on a witness stand.
Let me ask you. I understand, but there's the question. The real question is the credibility of the president, not the credibility of Michael Cohen. And the fact is, the president has changed his story repeatedly about whether or not he knew about hush money. Here is what he said on Air Force One. The president said on Air Force One this April, 8 months ago. President says he doesn't know anything about any payments, but in one of those tapes that you're talking about, where Cohen surreptitiously taped the president, this is back in September of 2016, here are the president and Cohen discussing a potential payment. Let's listen to the tape for a second.
Sure, I remember it well.
I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you. So,
No.
So which is it? Did the president know about the hush money payments or not?
Chris, there's an intervening event that you're not talking about. I know this really well because I got criticized for revealing this when I first came into the case, and nobody really understood why I was doing it. When I first came into the case, we went through the whole case. President saw some notes and documents, thought about it, and I went out and said, no, there was an intervening conversation after the payments took place and before the revelations you're talking about on Air Force One. The president did talk to Cohen or to people in between, and they arranged to reimburse Cohen. This was after the payment was made, after it was over, after the campaign was over.
They're talking about a conversation, sir, in September of 2016 during the campaign.
All right, well, that's part of the interview yesterday. Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani was on Fox News Sunday, and he said that later in the interview he will go on to say that President Trump will sit down one-on-one with special counsel Robert Mueller over my dead body. He was speaking with host Chris Wallace. We might go back and hear a little bit more of that later on, but I wanted to go back to our phone lines. Let me remind you again that you're listening to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan, the host on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:41 in the afternoon, and Corrine in St. Petersburg is on the line. Hi, Corrine. How's it going?
Hi, it's Corrine, but hello, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
That's all right. Everybody gets it wrong. Listen, I just want to say that in my point of view, there's no reason for people not to recycle plastics. We have, here in St. Petersburg, we have these big blue cans, and I know many, many people who never put them out on the street and who are drinking one-use bottles. It makes me crazy. When we first started recycling here in St. Petersburg, my amount of trash that I put in my regular trash that goes to the dump was less than half. There are some weeks when I don't even put out my can because it's not worth the gas for the girl to stop. Okay? So it's crazy that people don't do this. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It takes 2 seconds to separate your trash. And I've had people say, it's my trash, I'll do what I want with it. Well, they don't care about the earth. You know, it's like my doctor used to say, if you don't care about your health, don't worry, it'll go away.
Yeah, no kidding.
If you don't care about the earth, don't worry, it'll go away. So, you know, with this big flotilla out in the ocean, I see young scientists trying to find a way to get rid of that stuff. It's going to take so long to get rid of something that's a very simple answer. Either don't use it or recycle it. Oh, and I also wanted to say, industry is a little bit responsible, a lot responsible. I have a friend who's a long haul trucker that says, I cannot tell you how many times he's gone to an area and he sees these long haul truckers hauling plastic to the dump because the industry is just not capable of handling all the waste we make to make other things out of plastic. There's too much plastic, period. So my 2 cents. For today.
What do you think when some of the plastic does get recycled, as I see your point that not very much of it does, and so most of it gets landfilled. Is it worth it to you then to make that effort to recycle the plastic that you do have in order to, you know, help reduce the amount that goes into the landfill a little bit?
Of course it does. But when you have the industry that is recycling the plastic cannot handle the amount of plastic that it's getting, then we need to change something there. Because that's what's going on. That's why my friend said that he sees truckloads of plastic going to the dump because the industry that's recycling the plastic cannot stay up with the amount of plastic they're getting.
All right,
so it's going to landfill anyway, which is a crime. We need more people that are going to say, yeah, I'm going to make plastic shingles and plastic roofs for houses. I'm going to make something else, you know, things that we can use as plastic instead of using things like wood, you know?
Yeah, Corrine.
So that we could, you know, there's a lady that built a house out of plastic bottles down in Haiti. I mean, she just picked them up off the beach and made herself a house. So there.
Reduce, reuse, and recycle. And the third one is recycle. I think the first two are even more important, perhaps, reducing and reusing. But, Corinne, thank you.
Wait a second. I heard you had a doctor on before. I'd like to question him. I think that a girlfriend of mine her husband used to reuse his plastic bottles. And he died of pancreatic cancer. And I'm wondering if there's, you know, people don't reuse these bottles. It's not worth it.
That's true. I didn't mean to imply that people should reuse their plastic bottles because a lot of times plastic breaks down after.
Well, the PBAs can leach into your food. And that's what we're doing to the water. The PBAs, the bad stuff that the plastic's made out of is leaching into the water. And anybody can, you know, challenge me on this. I love it. You know, I love a good debate.
Great.
You know, think about this. Yeah, to me, it's a no-brainer. I've been recycling for years, and I also own 3 canteens.
All right, Corinne, thank you. And I hope that I'm sure they're metal or glass. So thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Corinne wanted to talk about our last show's topic, which was plastics, and that's great. A lot of people want to talk about reducing plastics. And if you missed it, last Thursday, the St. Pete City Council voted to ban single-use plastic straws starting a year from now in the city's restaurants and so forth. 813-239-9663. And we have Fonda on the line in Brandon. Hi, Fonda.
Hello, Sean. I know people I've seen in recycle bins who throw unclean items into recycling, and if the recycling company sees that there's a certain percentage of unclean items with food, for instance, oil, it cannot be recycled, and it's the whole load, the whole truckload is a waste and does have to go to the dump. So that's just my little aside. And when we order everything or so many things from Amazon, we're wasting a lot of trees, aren't we? So,
when you say that, make that connection for people.
About the boxes for shipping for Amazon, you mean?
Okay, so like rather than picking something up at your local store, you getting it shipped waste that cardboard.
That's right, and giving the business that we would be giving to our local shop owners is being lost.
Fonda, thanks for the call. I appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye. And David in Tampa, before you begin, I want to give out the number again. The number is 813-239-9663 if you want to talk about recycling or if you want to talk about Michael Cohen and the sentencing and how that connects to Donald Trump's administration. Give us a call, 813-239-9663. It's 12:48 in the afternoon. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. All right. So David in Tampa, you're on the line.
Yes, sir. I want to let you know that there is a solution to the plastic problem, and I'm really surprised that the people haven't utilized it. There is an additive that came out about 30 years ago. It's a small amount that you add to the polymer chain that allows the plastic only a certain amount of time. You can adjust the time, and then it dissolves into water. So the minute the sunlight is the trigger. And when sunlight triggers the plastic, and it could be a year, it could be 6 months, that's the end of the plastic. It's gone. It turns into water.
Well, but plastics are made out of benzene and other things that aren't soluble in water, so it wouldn't break down to just water. It would break down into these hydrocarbons at the, you know, even if it's not, if there's no more solids, I mean, you're still talking about hydrocarbons in the water in a dump.
Okay, I'm not a chemist, but The patent was obtained about 30 or 40 years ago. A company by the name of Plastigon utilizes it, and what they use it for is they cover their plants in this black plastic, and it used to be that they would pick up the plastic, but that was too much trouble. So they set the time so there's like 30 or 60 days and it's gone. Sunlight triggers it, and they don't ever have to pick it up again.
All right. Thank you for pointing that out, David.
All right. You can research it. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for letting us know about that. All right. 813-239-9663. Let me read an email from Michael out there in cyberspace. Michael says, aluminum is very easy to recycle and is probably 90% or more recycled. That's true. I think a lot of, it was interesting. A long time ago, it used to kind of be, it seemed, not as fancy to have beer in aluminum. But, you know, in the last decade or so, that's become a lot more common that when craft beers are put in aluminum cans, because I think, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is it's easier to recycle. I think that that's one of the reasons why some craft beer is canned now rather than it used to be bottled. It used to be, I guess, considered the premium way of doing it. And also, I think it's lighter to ship, and it's definitely... it's easier to recycle, and light can affect beverages like that. And so, aluminum keeps out the light. It is even better than brown glass. All right. Thanks for that tip. Michael says aluminum is very easy to recycle. 813-239-9663. Dedron in Brandon. How do you pronounce your name? I'm sorry.
Dedron, Dedron.
Thanks, Dedron, for calling in. What would you like to say?
Well, you know, everybody's talking about the recycling and things like that, but I don't understand why they just don't make it profitable. If they paid more, you know, to recycle and paid for plastic, then people would figure out a way to recycle plastics and reuse it if they just made it profitable like they do everything else. What's your take on that?
Well, I think you're right. How would you do that, though?
Well, you know, some states, if you turn in a can, you can get 5 cents. Possibly if you turn in plastic, you could get 5 cents per plastic bottle.
If we made
a law like that, then somebody would make it into a business, and they'll probably invent some kind of machine in order to make the plastics, you know, easier to recycle, which in turn would make somebody else make a machine, which makes it easier to break it down.
Yeah, I think there are some states that do that, if I'm not mistaken, that pay you a refundable deposit, I guess. So you pay up front for the bottle, and then you get the money back when you return the plastic bottle, just like some states do for glass bottles. Florida doesn't, neither one. And you think that it would be worth it to do that for plastics here in Florida?
I truly believe that would be worth it if we want to get, you know, if we want to just get it more under control. It would just be a more innovative industry if we just allowed industry to take it over instead of just saying chuck it in the garbage. Because like the lady said earlier, we can't recycle plastic fast enough. But if we industrialize it, we can. If we make it profitable for somebody, then we'd let capitalism basically make it. Get rid of the problem for us.
And I think that the bottleneck there is finding uses for the recycled plastic. And I've been to parks where they have what used to be wood. Benches and so forth are made out of recycled plastic, and decks are made out of recycled plastic. And I think that some road construction can be done with recycled plastic as one of the materials. But I don't think that there are enough companies right now with demanding the material, the plastic recycled, the recycled plastic in order to make those materials. And maybe if there were just more companies that were being innovative and using that, if we still continue to create the demand for that much plastic and that it has to be recycled, at least this is something that we could do with it. But I think one of our callers earlier, I believe it was Corinne, said, well, let's just cut down on the amount we use in the first place.
Yeah, but we're pretty dependent on plastic. It would be hard to cut. That's like saying cut down on the amount of drug use we use. Not illegal drugs, but just drugs in particular, and go towards a more natural way of doing it.
Yeah.
But we don't like to do that because this is the faster, easier route.
All right. Things to think about. Thanks, Dedron.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. And we have Nataj. Is that your name, Nataj?
Yeah, Nataj. Yeah, hi there.
Hi, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you know, the earlier caller was saying that you could make money, you know, by recycling plastic. If you read the recent news in California, a big gang got busted because they would bust in all kinds of plastic and bottles from the neighboring state.
Wait a second. Kramer did that.
No. I don't know. I remember reading about it, and
I'm just joking. That was on Seinfeld in the 90s, but yeah.
No, it actually happened. It actually happened, yes. And a gang got busted in California. You can read about it.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up. Thanks for pointing that out.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks, Nataj. Okay. 813-239-9663 is the number. Let's hear from Dave in Tampa.
Hey, yeah, listening to your conversation about recycling. And that was earlier this morning, too. It seemed to me the conversation lacks kind of an economic component at the front end, where plastic is made from petrochemicals. If you increase the input, the cost of the raw material with carbon dividend, I'll call it carbon dividend, you're going to make fresh plastic more expensive than reusable plastic, than recycled plastic. It's always the problem with recyclables has always been finding markets for it, which really boils down to a question of cost. If you increase the cost of putting a raw material into something, then people are going to start sourcing from cheaper supplies, which then creates a market for the recyclables. You're never going to be able to moralize your way to this solving this problem. It's got to be by market forces, at least in the economy, the way it's structured. So I think that carbon dividend plan, that's a great idea because it pays us back, but it also increases the cost of the raw material inputs on the products that we're trying to get out of the waste stream.
And I'm going to remind people what that is. I think it was about 2 weeks ago I had Representative Charlie Crist on here, Congressmember Crist, talking about a plan that he's introduced in with others in Congress called Carbon Fee and Dividend, in which people who pollute with burning fossil fuels will pay a fee, and then all those fees will be combined, and then it will be split up among all the people as a dividend. And now, plastics per se don't contribute to carbon emissions, but the raw material, as you point out, of that is fossil fuels. And so a carbon fee would definitely drive up the cost of fossil fuels, which would drive up the cost of the raw materials of plastic. And you're saying that kind of a side benefit of a carbon fee and dividend scheme would be that the cost of raw materials of plastic would be higher.
Absolutely would. And that's why I'm a little perplexed when I hear the Extinction Rebellion and the groups that talk about that are working on this. I never hear them advocate this solution. To me, this is the single best idea I've heard in terms of getting at this on a macro level. But for the exact reasons you just said, you increase raw costs, then markets are going to seek cheaper supplies. So what you've done is essentially you've changed the nature of the market and you've created a competitive advantage for your recyclables.
All right, good point. All right, thank you, Dave. Thanks for that. Thank you for that call. And I want to go now to, I lost your name, but whoever's calling from Bradenton, what's your name?
Terry.
Terry, you said?
Yes.
Go ahead, and you're on the air.
I'm from New York. We recycled aluminum and glass and plastic up there. Down here, I was pretty shocked that Florida didn't do much of that. But I know in the hometown, my mother lived in Tennessee in Dyersburg. There was a place called Dyersburg Knits. And I just happened to come across a video, I think on PBS one time, where they had, my family had worked in the knitting factory for years, long time ago. But they've changed it now where they use recycled bottles to make fleece fabric out of. That warm, fuzzy fleece there, everybody uses in the winter and keeps you nice, toasty, warm and blankets and stuff. That's what they've turned them into. So a lot could be done with it.
So as you came from a state that did have a deposit law and now it does not. I mean, and then now you move to someplace that does not.
Right.
Was that an inconvenience for you, or would it be an inconvenience for you to have the fee again?
No. No, I'm not rich either, but 5 cents, come on, no biggie. It keeps a lot less litter on the ground. And, I see around here people just throwing bottles out the window.
All right, well, thank you.
And if homeless people could pick them up for a reason and make some money, that would also help.
Okay, well, those are definitely thoughts that Florida should consider, and I want to thank you for that thought, Terry. And I want to thank everyone who called in today, who emailed and texted. If you're still on hold, you can leave a voicemail with your thoughts. Call me at 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next show. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news or on Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. I want to thank our engineer, Alvaro Montealegre, and our phone answerer, Frank Knotts. Frank Knox, that is. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF News Midpoint Monday, tomorrow at noon. Your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Right now, after NPR headlines, stay tuned for John Gilmore in executive session. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, Clearwater, and Lakeland. Thanks for listening.